we say hello to our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, Kimball.
I know what a fan you are of Chris Sale, and so you must feel badly for him today that poor Chris Sale, who couldn't pitch because of that broken pinky, but was still able to poorly navigate his bike enough to wreck his wrist and be out for the season. I'm shocked by this.
That makes it sound like I'm biased against him, and I think I'm quite measured in knowing what this guy is, and I've said it all along that he is a fraud. And what I would say here is the bike story, I don't believe it for a second. I think there's something else entirely going on with this guy, whether it's anger issues and he's pounding walls all the time, whether it's some kind of drug addiction. It's not just one fluke accident after another. I don't think there's a scintilla of truth in that.
No, I agree with you with that. It's way too suspicious, and we know, you know, he's got some anger issues. We saw it back in Chicago when he didn't like the throwback uniforms and cut them all up in the clubhouse.
That would have been enough of a stop sign for me to not acquire the guy. That is a level of behavior. What would you say to your son if he did that? Like, honestly, that's like an honest question. What would you say to him?
Well, he probably would not be doing anything fun or entertaining for quite some time after that.
And he's, what, an 8-year-old boy?
Yeah.
So you had a man in his, whatever he was at the time, late 20s, and that's what he's doing? That level of... The thing to me that was so telltale was the World Series. And people, they go, woo, over strikeouts. Hey, no one cares how you get the outs, just that you're out there and you get them, right? You really shouldn't care how they come. I mean, if you're going to rate strikeouts as the best, is a grounder the second better than a ground out to shortstop? There's no hierarchy with outs. Outs are outs, runs are runs. It doesn't matter how they come or they're gone. And he was getting his notoriety, his positive notoriety, because of those strikeouts. He was, for all the ballyhoo about 2018, the regular season, do you know that Clay Buchholz, of all people, had a much better season? Same amount of starts, pretty much. In 2013, better ERA, same exact number of wins, better win percentage. No one talks about it. And Chris Sale was like some agent planted on the Red Sox to do everything he could to stop them from winning that postseason. They won. It was mostly impressive because they won in spite of him. They won in spite of all of their stars, I would say. And they won because of, like, role players having these, like, moments of their life. But Chris Sale was a killer during that postseason. And for him, it's the phoniest moment in sports history to me. To lobby his manager to close out that bottom of the ninth in Los Angeles so he could have the forever photo of on the mound. Because we all know that, you know, Varitek running out to leap into Papelbon's arms and everything. This fake tough guy was lobbying to have that moment. It wasn't even a save. So 99% of the pitchers in the league would have closed out the game in that situation. And he just wanted his fake tough guy moment. There is something way wrong with this guy that will come out later.
I think you're absolutely right. We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. We're focusing on sports here on the segment this week. And let's shift to football and talk about the Hall of Fame candidacy of a beloved Patriots player, Stanley Morgan. Put up some impressive numbers in his career and lasted 14 years for a wide receiver. It's a pretty good run in the NFL.
Was that your sense, though, that when he was playing, did you think of him as beloved?
I thought so, yeah. Everybody I knew up here who was a Patriots fan loved him.
I think people were into him, but when I think of beloved players on those Patriots teams, he wouldn't be one of them to me. I think you have, and I'm not saying this is like a ranking in terms of ability or performance type of thing. I'd say John Hannah was beloved.
Oh, he was number one.
More beloved than Hannah, and this is what I mean about like not a talent thing. Grogan was beloved, and he kind of wasn't that good, but he was beloved for these other reasons. And then I think like you have Stanley Morgan is a little bit below Andre Tippett, and he was the way I experienced him at the time was that he was underappreciated, and part of the reason he was underappreciated was because, well, I think wide receivers could be in general back then. Like, if you look at the stats, people are so obtuse that they don't understand the context changes and the way games are played changes. They just look at the numbers and they compare them to the numbers of now.
Mm.
But Stanley Morgan was someone who did not have, even for the time, the best quarterbacks delivering him the ball. He had Grogan for a lot of it. I think Tony Eason was a player, quarterback, who could really throw, but he kind of needed an ideal world in which to throw. Do you know what I mean? If things got a little, like, pressury, he was kind of going to be all done. But, like, he must have been, like, the master of the 7-on-7 drill because he could sling it. And so you had these were not aerial attack offenses. And you'd have, like, the ground and pound and all that going on. But he put up some big numbers, and it's misleading in some ways because he's pretty high up. He's like in the top 12, I think, somewhere around there for yards per catch. But all of the guys in the yard per catch, like, top list, top 25, top 30, are guys from an earlier era because there was just that guy who essentially said to go deep.
And that
was like the level of sophistication of that. And like Willie Gault is high up on that list, and no one thinks of him as great. But Stanley Morgan, he put up some big numbers, including in 1986. He didn't just have over 1,400 yards receiving, which was a lot then. I mean, it's a lot now. He doubled the next closest guy on the team, which was a pretty good Irving Fryer.
He had 72 touchdowns in his career, nearly 12,000 yards. You mentioned the average, 19 yards per catch, and he averaged about 40 receptions per season for 14 years on some not great Patriot teams.
It wasn't a ball possession offense for the aerial attack. It was like trying to hit some big strikes each game. It wasn't like control. There weren't guys catching 100 balls a year in the slot. That just didn't happen. So like 40 receptions kind of seems like not so much. They were all deep balls, and a lot of those deep balls weren't thrown with touch, and he was having to fight for them and create a lot of separation. And I think he'll get in eventually, but I was disappointed to see the finalist list for the NFL or for the Football Hall of Fame recently, and that he didn't make it into that last grouping with a shot. I think he will get there, but to me, that's a big oversight to correct. And I look at the 1986 Patriots, and I was really young at the time. But looking back at them now after 85, and you had Eason who was healthy, and he was good in 86, that must have been such a disappointing year because they looked like they were going to make a lot of noise. They were 11-5 in the regular season, and they bowed out in that first round to the Broncos when they seemed to have a lot. This is the year after John Hannah, but they seemed to have a lot going for them, and then they just became this kind of like moribund franchise for a bunch of years.
Let's move to hockey, and it was a very interesting question. I love this because he was a favorite of mine. Pete Peters, of course, played here for the Maine Mariners for a couple of years, was terrific for them, but you asked the question, was he the best goaltender of the 1980s?
It's a trick question in some ways because when we do, it's arbitrary to say like a decade and to make it from like 80 to 89, because maybe you were amazing from like, I don't know, 74 to 84. So you have to have the bulk of the decade. So Patrick Roy, for instance, who's really going to start doing his thing in the middle of the 80s, I don't feel like you can call him the best goaltender. He didn't have the best decade. He was only around for half of it as a major player, and then he was kind of like splitting the top job. The 1980s is not a remarkable era for goalies. You have, like, Billy Smith has done pretty quickly in that. I mean, he hangs around for a while, but after, like, 83, he's really not the same. Grant Fuhr is there, but he has the high goals against average. The Oilers are giving up, like, 102-on-1s every night. He has the cocaine thing going on. He's, like, not focused. He's losing his job to Andy Moog every now and again. So that's happening. And, like, Mike Liut, okay, I feel like he's maybe the best goalie of the 1980s. but he gets a lot of blame. He shouldn't, but he gets a lot of the blame for the 1981 Canada Cup loss when they got drubbed 8-1 by the Soviets in that last game. You look at Peters, and it is strange because he does have the entire decade, especially if we give him credit for like 79-80 with the Flyers, if we cheat a little bit. He was really good. He wins the Vezina with what is maybe the definitive, I think it is, the definitive goaltending season of that decade. He was like whatever his record. I mean, they pretty much just played him. Like Doug Keynes was the backup. But he was all world for the Bruins in 82-83. He has like another year later on when he leads the league in goals against average. He's the goalie for the 1984 Canada Cup team. Now, part of that is because they didn't really have anyone else, and they didn't want to go back to Liut again after the 8-1 drubbing a few years before. But they win the 84 Canada Cup. That's like a big sort of like notch on the gun. And like Pete Peters becomes this, I'm not saying he's a Hall of Famer, but there are just guys who are closer than you think. And when you have the run of it for a decade, like Bill Freehan, the catcher for the Tigers, you're closer than maybe people think.
All right, another Hall of Fame candidacy. This one's pretty interesting, too, because the game was different back then. Dominic DiMaggio, the little professor, 11 years in the major leagues, and probably that relatively short tenure works against him, but he was a solid hitter and one of the best defensive players in the game.
It does work against him, but what I would say mitigates for him is that he lost 3 full years to service.
Mm.
So I'm someone who, when that happens, I give you a lot of credit for you being away. Like, I'll give you your prime years is like imaginary math. Like, I'll almost figure in for him 200 hits a season. Tough to get into the Hall of Fame as a hitter, nearly impossible, with less than 2,000 hits. And he has less than 2,000 hits. But he would have been over that if he had those 3 years, even if you're not giving him like 200 hits a season. He was the catalyst for some of the best offensive teams in baseball. Now, Williams was the guy who was driving that bus. He was making everything happen. But if you had to pick one catalyst, it wouldn't have been Pesky. It wouldn't have been Bobby Doerr, who was more of a masher. It would have been Dom DiMaggio, who is also another guy you know I'm no huge fan of, Jackie Bradley, although I've become less of a fan of Duran somehow. I don't know. It's close. But I think Bradley was just so ridiculously overrated as a defensive outfielder. If he was so good, what was there, a conspiracy against him? Why did he win only one gold glove? Like, was everyone like discriminating against him? Because I don't think that was happening. But someone like Dominic DiMaggio is never mentioned as one of their best defensive center fielders of all time. And he might be number two after your boy, Tristram Speaker.
Yeah, and he was a 7-time All-Star. He finished in the top 20 or so in MVP voting on a number of occasions as well. So clearly, the sports writers of the day understood what an important player he was to the Red Sox.
Ted Williams advocated for him, and Ted Williams wasn't one of those superstars like, for instance, Wayne Gretzky. When Wayne Gretzky says something about people, you just have to dismiss it. Everyone is the best ever. It would be like some fourth-line scrub. It's like, oh, Marty McSorley, you could really snipe. You just didn't see it come out because we asked him to play this other role. Like, that's not true, and you know it's not what he thinks. Ted Williams wasn't someone who would put the layer of icing on the cake. He just would be like, here, you'll eat it this way. And he was like a reality-first kind of guy. It's one of the reasons I admire him. So he would talk up Shoeless Joe Jackson. He was a big proponent for Negro League stars and Satchel Paige getting into the Hall of Fame, and he made that the crux of his own Hall of Fame speech, or certainly that was like the major takeaway of it. And he advocated a lot for Dominic DiMaggio, and it wasn't because of like, oh, his brother's Joe DiMaggio and we're rivals and Joe DiMaggio is taking MVP awards away from me, which he was, that he didn't deserve, because he had a lot of respect for Joe DiMaggio too. I think Williams was just someone who was hardened by and respected people who were quite good at what they did, and so I think his voice should carry a lot of weight, because he was no like Homer or a guy who you'd think, oh, this person belongs because I'm into them since they were my teammate. I think that, like, he knew, and so people should listen to that.
Let's talk pitching, and I love this question, too. Is Pedro Martinez's changeup the best pitch in the history of the game? Certainly in the conversation.
This is another one where I wondered this afternoon if I was cheating a little bit, because I think the changeup, I think it's the coolest pitch in all of baseball. It's just one of those cool things, like the backhander in hockey and hitting the other way, stuff I like.
Oh, I loved, as a baseball coach, I loved teaching guys. Because I used to have pitchers just throw fastball changeup. Teaching them that pitch, because if you do it right, you throw it with the same arm speed as the fastball. All you do is change that grip, lift those fingertips a little bit, and it's, if done right, it's an impossible pitch.
But it's also not an autonomous pitch. So that's right. How I was sort of wondering if it's, because, like, if the fastball goes completely, but you don't have, like, the requisite separation. So it is, like, the coolest pitch, and it can be the best ever pitch that is out there. But it also exists in conjunction with other things you do. So I'm cheating a little bit. But it speaks, I think, almost to, like, how dim sometimes people can be, that if he didn't have the fastball, like in that famous game against Cleveland in 99, that they were still so scared of the fastball, which he didn't have. It was obvious he didn't have it. And he was throwing, like, whatever it was, 80% changeups, and he was just shutting them down completely. That they were so in fear of the fastball. You made the adjustment and just sat on the change. But his changeup wasn't just devastating, is that he would throw it in any count. He'd be behind 3-0, and he'd drop that changeup in there. And you just think of, like, these sort of all-time great pitches. I don't want to hear the Nolan Ryan fastball thing, because he was so wild with it. And even when he was in the zone, I didn't ever feel like it was going exactly where he wanted it to go. And a lot of guys can just rear back and throw hard. I think he's so overrated. I think of, like, Hoyt Wilhelm's knuckleball, but that's fluky. And
yeah, I had Bob Feller's curveball, which was apparently pretty devastating. Tom Seaver's slider. And then I think you have to include, because it was the only pitch he had, Mariano Rivera's cutter.
Yeah, I would put Roger Clemens' split finger fastball in there too.
Yep.
Because that was another one where it's like when you're a kid and you're in Little League, you're like, I'm going to lay off the high pitch. And it's like over your head and you can't help yourself. That was like the opposite, his split finger, where it's like, I'm going to lay off, but it would come in at the knees and then it would be gone and bounce in front of the plate. The level of deception when he developed it, because he didn't have it like in 86. Like, it took him a little while to get to it. And then it became like this pitch that he seemed to throw more than any other pitch. But for a while, he was like this two-pitch guy. And a lot of it was fastballs and the occasional curve. So I would just think there was, with Pedro Martinez, as much as I think he's overrated because he never won a championship when he was the guy, and his 2004 season was fine, but it wasn't up to his standards. And I think he broke down faster than he should have, and he had pitch counts. He always seemed to be coming out of games when it was like 1-1. So he was going to get a no decision. But there was an artistry, a thinking artistry to how he pitched that to me was just encapsulated in that changeup. So it was always a favorite of mine.
All right. And finally, what a great question. Who would win a hypothetical series between the two great runner-up Red Sox teams, the 75 Red Sox and the 86 Red Sox? And they're similar in a lot of ways. Both teams won 95 games in the regular season. Both teams went to the seventh game of the World Series against the winningest team in a single season of each decade, the big red machine of the 70s, and I think it was the 108-win Mets of 1986.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And my initial sense was it was reversed. I think about the seven, and of course I love Carlton Fisk so much, and I think about that 75 team and splashy stars. And you had Rice, and we'll assume that Rice is present for the series, and the hypothetical series. He was, of course, hurt for the 75 World Series. Fred Lynn doing what he did, and Rookie of the Year, and more importantly, MVP. And Yastrzemski could still deliver. He's going to certainly rebound in 76 and 77, have some nice years that are quite underrated, especially if you look at where he is in the leaderboard. So he still had something left. And that they took this team, I don't think you can say this about the 86 Mets, but the 75 and 76 Reds are in the discussion for the best team of all time.
Yes.
They're a top 10 team. They're just one of those teams. So that the Red Sox could take them that far and have that lead and blow that last game, at least to a degree. I mean, it wasn't like some epic collapse, but they had it, would seem to speak to how good they were. The more I thought about this, though, I think the 86 Red Sox, with their starting pitching, they had a lot of offense, too.
And their bullpen.
If you look at the numbers for the bullpen for the 86 Red Sox, it's pretty bad. There's a reason why. I mean, it's dire. It truly is. Like, even like Bob Stanley's one of the better relievers they have, and his ERA is like 4.4. And so you sort of look at the numbers for that bullpen, and you can see how Mr. Schiraldi became like this would-be bullpen savior for them, and we know how that ended up. But they had some horses in the starting rotation. Now, Wade Boggs was just, you thought at the time, it's like, oh, it was average, and that was his thing. He was just such a force in baseball at that time, especially in that ballpark. You still had Rice, and he's maybe even a little bit better in 86. I don't know. They're quite similar years statistically.
Well, I think, Evans, you know, Buckner was better in 86, I think, than Yaz was in 75. Marty Barrett was a better second baseman than Doug Griffin. And I think the 86 versions of Rice and Evans might have been better than the 75 versions.
Buckner, yeah, if you go by old school stats, if you go by OPS plus and WAR, I mean, like, what's the guy's WAR for his entire career? And he almost had 3,000 hits. His WAR is like 16. And it's like right around like Dave Kingman, because he was this station to station, a lot of times, single hitter. And RBI is kind of like a tricky statistic. You had Clemens doing his MVP thing, and I think that's big. But to me, what would make me give it to the 86 Red Sox is Bruce Hurst. Bruce Hurst was a guy, maybe it wasn't like this like overpoweringly impressive one-loss record, but we spoke about strikeouts before, and for what that's worth, he was striking out more batters per nine. He might have ended up more batters per nine at the end of the year, but he was hurt. But for a while, at least, it was more than Clemens. And Boyd was more than, Oil Can Boyd was more than serviceable. He's winning like 16 games for that team. So I think if you're bringing out like an ace, 1A and 1B, because Clemens and Hurst were close. You have the right-hander, the flamethrower. Then you have the big lefty who can throw hard too, and is talking about curves, is dropping that nasty hook in there. It's like there are these like teams that don't win with they used to be. Now everyone can focus on the winners. But the 67 team, I don't think they're as good as either of these two teams, although they're more beloved. The 46 team would probably be both of them. But I just think it's an interesting comparison, because in my mind, I always think of the 75 Red Sox as like magical. And you always think of the 86 Red Sox as like, that sucked. But they were a really good team, and I think they would have taken it.
Yeah, you look at the bench, too. I mean, the addition of Spike Owen late in the season gave them some depth. Steve Lyons played well off the bench. Dave Henderson with some big contributions for them in the postseason as well. Yeah, they just had a lot of moving parts that knew their role and did the job.
And Henderson was better. Like, at the time, you thought he was a role player, and then he had those big moments you spoke of. But he was actually going to be a star himself. He was almost like Kevin Mitchell was to the Mets, you know what I mean? Where he didn't win an MVP, obviously, like Mitchell. But he blossomed into this kind of star on his own, right, once he was a member of the Oakland A's. Don Baylor was, this will sound funny now to Red Sox fans, but at the time he was like this proto version of David Ortiz.
Mm.
Clutch guy, veteran guy, big hit guy, no-nonsense guy, who looked like he couldn't move, who used to steal a lot of bases, which even now when I look back, because my image in my memory is just him standing at the plate and either jacking one or getting drilled and not even flinching or trying to get out of the way. And so I think like Denny Doyle and Spike Owen kind of a wash. I mean, they're quite similar teams, and I just like the idea, too, that you had a couple guys on both squads, which seems like something that wouldn't happen anymore. And also, as much as, again, as I love Fisk, there was a time when Rich Gedman, small window, but he was a really good catcher in the league. He was one of the five or six best catchers in the league. And so on both sides, both offensively and defensively. So no real holes on that 86 Red Sox team.
I got to know Oil Can a little bit when he was pitching for a minor league team here in Bangor for a while. And he insisted then, I'm sure he still does today, that if McNamara had thrown him in game 7, they'd have won that World Series.
These teams were not certainly distinguished by, I mean, Darryl Johnson was fine, I guess. McNamara, there was just always something off to me about that guy. You know, another guy who just seemed off to me, and maybe it was because he was older. I thought of him as older. He's probably like 58 at the time.
The major.
Was Ralph Houk.
Yeah.
Where he just seemed like such a dick. Like he wasn't even, McNamara sounded that way too. And not like, I mean, I this is a soundbite, I enjoy a dick. I do. Someone who's like a hard ass. But it has to be within like some strategic context rather than like splenetic apathy. It sounds like a mixed metaphor, but that was kind of the vibe I got with McNamara, even like as a kid, thinking like, this guy, you have to sort of win despite him. He's not going to be doing these amazing moves. But I guess that's the nature of baseball too, right? It's why I feel like Gil Hodges, that 1969 Met, you'd think like that, being the manager of that team, would have gotten him in the Hall of Fame earlier with his on-the-field accomplishment. But people don't really care about baseball managers that much. It's not like football coaches. I think a lot of it is consistency and filling up the lineup card and who's on your roster. I mean, I'm no big Alex Cora guy, but I don't know how you're supposed to win with what he was provided this year. So, I don't know. I love the 86 team, like growing up, because that I was like that perfect age, like 10, 11 sort of thing. And it seemed that was like the pennant race. That was my first pennant race with the team I cared about, really. I mean, I was technically alive in 75, but it was 78. I was too young. So this was really my first go round.
I was in college, but working in radio when Houk was first hired as manager, and I would get out to spring training and be out on the field and doing a few interviews and things like that. And my impression of Ralph Houk was that he was completely retired. He was collecting a paycheck and letting the boys do what they did. I didn't see a lot of, that was spring training to be sure, but I didn't see a lot of managing going on.
You know, what's funny is because when the Yankees, they drummed out Casey Stengel, they wanted to get rid of him like earlier than they did. And he was around, he got a lot of the blame in New York for the 1960 World Series loss against the Pirates, where the Yankees outscored them like cumulatively by some ridiculous amount and lost in the Mazeroski walk-off in game 7. Ralph Houk was brought in as like this energy infuser for his like young pep. The 61 team, and like that was the Mantle and Maris, the 61 and 54 home run season. And when he was on the Red Sox in like 83, because that was Yaz's last year, so I was paying a lot of attention to them. So that's really like I thought he was like 200 years old, and learning later, because I was just crazy about baseball history, that he was like the young Turk, like the infusion of the new blood for the Yankees. I thought that was and I know Jerry Remy hated him. Because what did he say to Remy? Like, Remy had all the knee problems. And Houk said to Remy, it's like, Mantle had knee problems. Classic dickhood. Yeah. Like Mantle.
He was 42 when the Yankees hired him. 41.
But he was like, he was one of those guys, too. I saw, you know, how Olivia Newton-John died the other day.
Mm.
So there was a photo of her with Phil Niekro in for the Braves and the clubhouse. Niekro, he's like 35. He's like, whatever it is. Isn't it remarkable? He looks like he's, speaking of 108, he looks like he's 108. If I knew someone my age who looked like that, I would write a short story with a supernatural angle about it because they weirded me out so much. So,
well, yeah, you know what it's like to look at those some baseball cards from the 60s and 70s and some of those guys who were 32 but looked about 58.
You know who is another good one, speaking of the Reds, is Sparky Anderson.
Oh, yeah.
His baseball card from like 1969 the other day. And people out there, look it up. It'll blow your... Then go and look up his actual age, because he's like 40. I wonder if a lot of these guys were listening to old-time radio, like I do now. And they were hearing all those cigarette commercials on Gunsmoke and were thinking, this advertising sounds really tempting. It's working on me. And they just went like... Because when you listen to the commercials on Gunsmoke, any of like the old-time radio, not only do they are they super aggressive about cigarettes, they make it sound like they're like beneficial for your health. So I don't know. Maybe all of these guys just got into like Marshall Dillon and they're smoking up a storm, and then you Phil Negro, 35, looking like you're 100, and blowing my mind as a Zulu warrior. So there it is.
Smoking up a storm and never even having heard of sunscreen. So they had that leathered skin, and it was a beautiful time.
Yeah, well, you were, you were around Ralph Houk. You at spring training. You with Fisk. You should pen your memoirs, like, and call it something like Baseball Diary of a College Announcer. You'd have something there, Kimball.
I don't know if I may have told you the story about, I was maybe, 20, perhaps. And they finished a spring training game, and Yaz came off the field. And I was wearing my little press pass. And I said, Yaz, could I get you to sign this ball? And he stopped, and he looked at me. And he sees my press pass, and he goes, Are you a reporter or a GD fan? And then ran off, never to be seen again.
Well, that's you violated an unwritten rule.
I did,
right?
I did.
So once you have the press pass, once you're on that side, then it's like you're a guy who's getting balls signed to sell them out of the back of your car. I mean, then you have like a conflict of interest. I think is how that's looked at. So it's like. It's a big deal. Nowadays, if that happened, you could go on Twitter and shame the guy and get a lot of likes and a lot of sympathy. But I like that world when you could just say things like that to just to people, or like even to children. It helps them. Do you remember that episode of Cheers when Carla's like cheering so hard for Yaz?
Yes.
And like he pops up at the end and she calls him a fossil. He's like 41.
Oh, yeah.
But he was another guy who looked older than he was. Like, you look at his 1983 Topps card. I mean, it's a great card. And his OPS Plus was still over like 100 at the end, which blows my mind. But you would never think that he was only like 43. I mean, he looks on that card older than you are now. And you had like 20 years on him.
But yeah, like, but he was doing about 4 packs a day then, I think.
Oh, he was a big smoker. Well, he was one of those guys then. Then I guess it didn't catch up with him, which is, it's weird how that works. You see, like, what happens to Mike Bossy and other guys like that, and then other people are just smoking a pack a day or whatever it is, and I feel like he's mellowed somewhat as this guy in his 80s now. I feel like he's a touch maybe more gregarious than he was when he was playing, when he just seemed like pretty... humorless, I would say. Like, I couldn't imagine him like cracking a joke and laughing.
He was very shy. I had a chance to work with him a little bit when he was doing some TV commercials after he retired. And yeah, he was shy, and he didn't enjoy the attention. He appreciated the support of the fans, but he would much rather just sit back in the corner having a smoke and playing cribbage.
Yes. And a guy, too, that has become, people talk about him like a compiler, but again, for you Boston sports fans out there, go look at his baseball reference page. There's a lot of respect to be had for his game because he was leading the league in a whole bunch of different categories throughout his career. I mean, oftentimes, like, I think it was 1974, so the year before this World Series run, I believe he led the American League in runs scored. That, to me, is like a huge category. That's that's another like impressive notch. And he was still doing it after like a lot of the power had gone. And like in 76, I think he was third in the league in RBI. And you don't think that when you just look at the raw number of like whatever it was, 102 RBI. But Craig Nettles was leading the league with 32 home runs. There was no offense for like 10 years.
And he had a season where he stole 23 bases too.
Yeah, he was one of those outfielders who had great range. And I think this is a cool thing about baseball is you can have great range and not have great speed. So you can even be like a great defensive center fielder and not have amazing speed. Certainly you can be like a great defensive shortstop and not have amazing speed, because it speaks to like your in hockey, we always talk about hockey sense. We don't talk about baseball sense, but there is such a thing, reading the ball off the bat, that kind of thing. And he was a heady base stealer. If you remember, Carlton Fisk would steal quite a few bases for a catcher. And he had like okay speed, certainly for a catcher, but he was stealing it on his intellect.
Yeah.
And I feel like Yaz was a very headsy player that same way. It, you know what? Another way you see it with him is how he would play left field, how he'd play that wall, how he would deep guys.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see people even try that anymore. It's like they don't bother. But he seemed to me on the field as a guy who was always, always thinking.
No question about it. Great conversation as always. Colin, thank you much, my friend. We'll do it again next week.
All right. Sounds good.
Colin Fleming with us on Downtown.